Chapter 9. His shout rang out like the blast of a warning trumpet, between the iron walls of the engine room. Painted white, they rose high into the dusk of the skylight, sloping like a roof, and the whole lofty space resembled the interior of a monument, divided by floors of iron grating, with lights flickering at different levels, and a mass of gloom lingering in the middle, within the columnar stir of machinery under the motionless swelling of the cylinders. A loud and wild resonance, made up of all the noises of the hurricane, dwelt in the still warmth of the air. There was in it the smell of hot metal, of oil, and a slight mist of steam. The blows of the sea seemed to traverse it in an unringing, stunning shock, from side to side. Gleams, like pale long flames, trembled upon the polish of metal. From the flooring below, the enormous crankheads emerged in their turns with a flash of brass and steel going over, while the connecting rods, big jointed, like skeleton limbs, seemed to thrust them down and pull them up again with an irresistible precision. And deep in the half-light, other rods dodged deliberately to and fro, crossheads nodded, discs of metal rubbed smoothly against each other, slow and gentle, in a commingling of shadows and gleams. Sometimes all those powerful and unerring movements would slow down simultaneously, as if they had been the functions of a living organism, stricken suddenly by the blight of languor, and Mr. Outsize would blaze darker in his long sallow face. He was fighting this fight in a pair of carpet slippers. A short shiny jacket barely covered his loins, and his white wrists protruded far out of the tight sleeves, as though the emergency had added to his stature, had lengthened his limbs, augmented his pallor, hollowed his eyes. He moved, climbing high up, disappearing low down, with a restless, purposeful industry, and when he stood still, holding the guardrail in front of the starting gear, he would keep glancing to the right at the steam gauge, at the water gauge, fixed upon the white wall in the light of a swaying lamp. The mouths of two speaking tubes gaped stupidly at his elbow, and the dial of the engine room telegraph resembled a clock of large diameter, bearing on its face curt words instead of figures. The grouped letters stood out heavily black, around the pivot head of the indicator, emphatically symbolic of loud exclamations. Ahead, astern, slow, half, stand by, and the fat black hand pointed downwards to the word full, which, thus singled out, captured the eye as a sharp cry secures attention. The wood-encased bulk of the low-pressure cylinder, frowning portly from above, emitted a faint wheeze at every thrust, and except for that low hiss, the engines worked their steel limbs headlong or slow with a silent, determined smoothness. And all this, the white walls, the moving steel, the floor plates under Solomon Rout's feet, the floors of iron grating above his head, the dusk and the gleams, uprose and sank continuously, with one accord, upon the harsh wash of the waves against the ship's side. The whole loftiness of the place, booming hollow to the great voice of the wind, swayed at the top like a tree, would go over bodily, as if borne down this way, and that by the tremendous blasts. "You've got to hurry up," shouted Mr. Rout, as soon as he saw Jukes appear in the stokehold doorway. Jukes' glance was wandering and tipsy. His red face was puffy, as though he had overslept himself. He had had an arduous road, and had traveled over it with immense vivacity, the agitation of his mind corresponding to the exertions of his body. He had rushed up out of the bunker, stumbling in the dark alleyway amongst a lot of bewildered men who, trod upon, asked, "Hats up, sir?" In awed mutters all round him. Down the stokehold ladder, missing many iron rungs in his hurry, down into a place deep as a well, black as tophead, tipping over back and forth like a seesaw. The water in the bilges thundered at each roll, and lumps of coal skipped to and fro, from end to end, rattling like an avalanche of pebbles on a slope of iron. Somebody in there moaned with pain, and somebody else could be seen crouching over what seemed the prone body of a dead man. A lusty voice blasphemed, and the glow under each fire door was like a pool of flaming blood radiating quietly in a velvety blackness. A gust of wind struck upon the nape of Jupe's neck, and next moment he felt it streaming about his wet ankles. The stokehold ventilators hummed. In front of the six fire doors, two wild figures, stripped to the waist, staggered and stooped, wrestling with two shovels. "Hallo! Plenty of draft now," yelled the second engineer at once, as though he had been all the time looking out for Jukes. The donkeyman, a dapper little chap with a dazzling fair skin and a tiny, gingery mustache, worked in a sort of mute transport. They were keeping a full head of steam, and a profound rumbling, as of an empty furniture van trotting over a bridge, made a sustained bass to all the other noises of the place. "Blowing off all the time," went on yelling the second. With a sound, as of a hundred scoured saucepans, the orifice of a ventilator spat upon his shoulder a sudden gush of salt water, and he volleyed a stream of curses upon all things on earth including his own soul, ripping, and raving, and all the time attending to his business. With a sharp clash of metal the ardent pale glare of the fire opened upon his bullet head, showing his spluttering lips, his insolent face, and with another clang closed like the white-hot wink of an iron eye. "Where's the blooming ship? Can you tell me? Blast my eyes. Underwater, or what? It's coming down here in tons. Are the condemned cowls gone to Hades? Hey? Don't you know anything, you jolly sailor man, you?" Dot, question mark, Jukes, after a bewildered moment, had been helped by a roll to dart through, and as soon as his eyes took in the comparative vastness, peace and brilliance of the engine room, the ship, setting her stern heavily in the water, sent him charging head down upon Mr. Rout. The chief's arm, long like a tentacle, and straightening as if worked by a spring, went out to meet him, and deflected his rush into a spin towards the speaking tubes. At the same time Mr. Rout repeated earnestly, "You've got to hurry up, whatever it is." Jukes yelled, "Are you there, sir?" and listened. Nothing. Suddenly the roar of the wind fell straight into his ear, but presently a small voice shoved aside the shouting hurricane quietly. "You, Jukes? Well?" Jukes was ready to talk. It was only time that seemed to be wanting. It was easy enough to account for everything. He could perfectly imagine the coolies battened down in the reeking tween deck, lying sick and scared between the rows of chests. Then one of these chests or perhaps several at once breaking loose in a roll, knocking out others, sides splitting, lids flying open, and all these clumsy Chinamen rising up in a body to save their property. Afterwards every fling of the ship would hurl that tramping, yelling mob here and there, from side to side, in a whirl of smashed wood, torn clothing, rolling dollars. A struggle once started, they would be unable to stop themselves. Nothing could stop them now except main force. It was a disaster. He had seen it, and that was all he could say. Some of them must be dead, he believed. The rest would go on fighting. ... He sent up his words, tripping over each other, crowding the narrow tube. They mounted as if into a silence of an enlightened comprehension dwelling alone up there with a storm. And Jukes wanted to be dismissed from the face of that odious trouble intruding on the great need of the ship. He waited. Before his eyes the engines turned with slow labor, that in the moment of going off into a mad fling would stop dead at Mr. Rout's shout, "Look out, Beale!" They paused in an intelligent immobility, stilled in mid-stroke, a heavy crank arrested on the cant, as if conscious of danger and the passage of time. Then, with a "Ow, then!" from the chief, and the sound of a breath expelled through clenched teeth, they would accomplish the interrupted revolution and begin another. There was the prudent sagacity of wisdom, and the deliberation of enormous strength in their movements. This was their work, this patient coaxing of a distracted ship over the fury of the waves and into the very eye of the wind. At times Mr. Rout's chin would sink on his breast, and he watched them with knitted eyebrows, as if lost in thought. The voice that kept the hurricane out of Jukes' ear began, "Colon, take the hands with you. ... And left off unexpectedly. What could I do with them, sir? A harsh, abrupt, imperious clang exploded suddenly. The three pairs of eyes flew up to the telegraph dial to see the hand jump from full to stop, as if snatched by a devil. And then these three men in the engine room had the intimate sensation of a check upon the ship, of a strange shrinking, as if she had gathered herself for a desperate leap. "Stop her!" bellowed Mr. Rout. Nobody, not even Captain McWhirr, who alone on deck, had caught sight of a white line of foam coming on at such a height that he couldn't believe his eyes. Nobody was to know the steepness of that sea, and the awful depth of the hollow the hurricane had scooped out behind the running wall of water. It raced to meet the ship, and, with a pause, as of girding the loins, the Nanshan lifted her bows and leaped. The flames in all the lamps sank, darkening the engine room. One went out. With a tearing crash and a swirling, raving tumult, tons of water fell upon the deck, as though the ship had darted under the foot of a cataract. Down there they looked at each other, stunned. Swept from end to end, by God. Ball Jukes. She dipped into the hollow straight down, as if going over the edge of the world. The engine room toppled forward menacingly, like the inside of a tower nodding in an earthquake. An awful racket, of iron things falling, came from the stokehold. She hung on this appalling slant long enough for Beale to drop on his hands and knees, and begin to crawl, as if he meant to fly on all fours out of the engine room, and for Mr. Rout to turn his head slowly, rigid, cavernous, with the lower jaw dropping. Jukes had shut his eyes, and his face in a moment became hopelessly blank and gentle, like the face of a blind man. At last she rose slowly, staggering, as if she had to lift a mountain with her bows. Mr. Rout shut his mouth. Jukes blinked, and little Beale stood up hastily. "Another one like this, and that's the last of her," cried the chief. He and Jukes looked at each other, and the same thought came into their heads. The captain. Everything must have been swept away. Steering gear gone, ship like a log. All over directly. "Rush," ejaculated Mr. Rout thickly, glaring with enlarged, doubtful eyes at Jukes, who answered him by an irresolute glance. The clang of the telegraph gong soothed them instantly. The black hand dropped in a flash from stop to full. "Now then, Beale," cried Mr. Rout. The steam hissed low. The piston rod slid in and out. Jukes put his ear to the tube. The voice was ready for him. It said, "Pick up all the money. Bear a hand now. I'll want you up here." And that was all. "Sir?" called up Jukes. There was no answer. He staggered away like a defeated man from the field of battle. He had got, in some way or other, a cut above his left eyebrow, a cut to the bone. He was not aware of it in the least. Quantities of the China Sea, large enough to break his neck for him, had gone over his head, had cleaned, washed, and salted that wound. It did not bleed, but only gaped red, and this gash over the eye, his disheveled hair, the disorder of his clothes, gave him the aspect of a man worsted in a fight with fists. "Got to pick up the dollars." He appealed to Mr. Rout, smiling pitifully at random. "What's that?" asked Mr. Rout, wildly. "Hiccup. ... I don't care. ... then, quivering in every muscle, but with an exaggeration of paternal tone, "Go away now, for God's sake. You deck people will drive me silly. There's that second mate been going for the old man. Don't you know? You fellows are going wrong for want of something to do." ... At these words Jukes discovered in himself the beginnings of anger. Want of something to do indeed. ... Full of hot scorn against the chief, he turned to go the way he had come. In the stokehold the plump donkeyman toiled with his shovel mutely, as if his tongue had been cut out. But the second was carrying on like a noisy, undaunted maniac, who had preserved his skill in the art of stoking under a marine boiler. "Hallo, you wandering officer. Hey, can you get some of your slush slingers to wind up a few of the mashes? I am getting choked with them here. Curse it. Hallo. Hey, Remember the articles. Sailors and firemen to assist each other. Hey! Do you hear? Jukes was climbing out frantically, and the other, lifting up his face after him, howled, "Can you speak? What are you poking about here for? What's your game, anyhow?" A frenzy possessed Jukes. By the time he was back amongst the men in the darkness of the alleyway, he felt ready to wring all their necks at the slightest sign of hanging back. The very thought of it exasperated him. He couldn't hang back. They shouldn't. The impetuosity with which he came amongst them carried them along. They had already been excited and startled at all his comings and goings by the fierceness and rapidity of his movements. And more felt than seen in his rushes, he appeared formidable, busied with matters of life and death, that brooked no delay. At his first word he heard them drop into the bunker one after another obediently, with heavy thumps. They were not clear as to what would have to be done. Had it? What is it? They were asking each other. The boatswain tried to explain. The sounds of a great scuffle surprised them. And the mighty shocks, reverberating awfully in the black bunker, kept them in mind of their danger. When the boatswain threw open the door, it seemed that an eddy of the hurricane, stealing. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.